Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business, the podcast we do here at Risky Biz HQ, which is mostly for the policymaker and government type sets. My name, of course, is Patrick Gray, and joining me is Tom Uren. G'day, Tom.
G'day, Pat. How are you?
Good. And before we get going, thanks, of course, to the Hewlett Foundation Cyber Initiative for supporting this work, and also to our founding corporate sponsor for this podcast, Proofpoint. Now, Tom, you know, you've finished your newsletter. It's about to go out. And, you know, as usual, very, very interesting stuff. The first item that you've included in the newsletter isn't really an item on its own. It's not analysis of a single incident. What you've done is you've looked at just what's been going on in the cyber world over the last month and sort of added it all up and pointed out that things are kind of crazy at the moment.
Yeah, it's quite considerable, the amount of stuff that is just going on. And each week I kind of look at the news that's going on and go, okay, this is really important. I need to say something about this. And recently it's been a whole lot of incidents that I go, wow, that's really important, but I don't actually have space to talk about it. There's something bigger going on. So, for example, I wrap up in this piece the attacks on national governments, and there have been many quite significant ones, Chile, Costa Rica, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Herzegovina.
That got me yesterday as well, but yeah, go on.
like all just in the last couple of months, and those governments have suffered from that. And then destructive attacks, of course, are going on. Iran and Israel, the attack on Albania and its diplomatic reaction, and then another attack. Things are going bonkers there. And that's not even including the war in Ukraine, which I consider a special case.
Mm.
Then we've actually got genuine hacktivists have appeared in the last couple of months. So we've spoken quite a few times about the Belarusian cyber partisans, but there's actually a group in South America that I've seen a couple of times, and it's always been one of those, this is significant, but there's just no space to talk about it. And they are railing against the exploitation of natural resources in South America. And they stole like a huge amount of data just recently. So every different class of attacker is making hay. So we've also got Lapsus in the last couple of weeks, who are basically teenagers.
They claimed Uber as a scalp and also Rockstar Games. And you haven't even mentioned the latest $160 million crypto DeFi theft, which, you know, as you say, like as part of our jobs with Risky Business, we sit down and we monitor the headlines. Like we basically see reports of everything that's going on out there. And it's just amazing what these days you just select and delete from your list to go and analyze, right? Like it's stuff that would have been front page news years ago. It's just like, can't be bothered talking about that one this week.
The cryptocurrency one, I think, is particularly interesting there because it very rapidly went from the tens of millions to the hundreds of millions. And then it was hundreds of millions every single week.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, just another 150 million stolen.
Exactly. Like barely rates are mentioned.
And so then I'd only talk about the ones where there was enough technical detail that it was actually a really well-executed attack. And that's the sort of different part. Anyway, I was saying that there's just every single class of attacker. So it's not just state-based attackers that are doing really well. It's cryptocurrency thieves, it's cyber criminals, and then it's teenagers and hacktivists. And that, to me, indicates that there's not something special about any one of these groups. It's the environment they're operating in. So the balance between people who are trying to defend networks and people who are trying to attack them has shifted in favor of the attackers.
See, I don't see it in quite those terms. Like I get what you're saying, but I don't see it as the playing field having been tilted in favor of attackers. I just see that various categories of attackers are now entrenched. They're established. And, you know, it's almost like when you get product categories emerge in security, like someone invents a new thing and then all of a sudden there's 10 companies doing the same thing. And it feels like we're seeing a variation of that happen, it's not even the underground either, is it? Because we're talking about state-backed activity. I mean, one thing that you mentioned, is the Kiwi Farm stuff, where it turns out Kiwi Farms got owned and a bunch of people there are going to get doxxed. So we're seeing everything from hacktivists to random people, you know, presumably who just want to make Kiwi farmers' lives hard, to state-backed destructive attacks, ransomware, like just everything. And it just feels like all of these categories now are well-established.
Yeah, I always try and think of what's the reason for what I'm seeing. And the best I can come up with for this is that there's a kind of state of the art for criminals, and that's just advanced ever so slightly ahead of the lagging, you know, the baseline security that's typically everywhere. And I guess one particular example is the ability of criminals to get around MFA nowadays.
Yeah.
And see, that seems to have gone from quite rare at the beginning of the year, like this is a new thing, this is interesting, to just everyone is doing it. And that seems to have made it much, much easier for all types of threat actors to get, I guess get to first base. And once you're on first base, it's much easier to progress than it is if you're stopped by MFA in the first place. So that's kind of what I've been thinking about. But anyway, the end result is that it's just chaos everywhere. A huge amount of impactful news that's getting short shrift because there's just no space to talk about it. And so the question is, what do you do about that? I suppose we're at a phase where we can't focus on just stopping bad things happen. We have to accept that bad things are happening all the time. And how do you recover from them? How do you minimize them?
I mean, it's almost like the climate change stuff, right? Which is, there's an element of policy that's going to have to focus on adaptation. And the longer we go, the more you have to focus on adaptation rather than prevention. It almost feels like we're in a similar spot with cyber chaos, right? Where increasingly we're going to have to think about how we make our way through an environment where all of these sort of activities are so pervasive. You're not going to be able to completely dial the chaos back. So, you know, you're going to have to think about, well, what does it look like from a policy perspective when that's the environment you're in? What does it look like from a policy perspective when this shift is a structural shift and not just a bunch of coincidences of lots of bad things happening at once?
Yeah, yeah. The chaos monkeys are out of the zoo and we're not going to be able to get them back in anytime soon.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, what does that look like? I mean, I'd imagine that, you know, certainly governments should be perhaps drilling a little bit more on disaster recovery and planning around what they do for incidents and how to respond to them and whatnot.
Yeah, I think it's always easy to say that beforehand, and I guess this is what we're doing, but it's much harder for governments to actually find the motivation to do that prior to a big accident. And so I guess we're really just putting, or a big incident, so I guess we're just putting a stake in the ground so that we'll be able to say we told you so later.
Yeah, just doing something useful, which is setting ourselves up to be smug and victorious later. Now, the second thing you went in depth on this week was a Atlantic Council report that looked at the Chinese vulnerability disclosure laws. Now, these are the ones that, you know, a lot of Americans are convinced these laws are designed to sort of stop Chinese vulnerability researchers from being able to report stuff to vendors. And they, you know, it's a way for the Ministry of State Security to capture bugs and things like that. But surprisingly, well, not surprisingly for you, at least, this Atlantic Council report found that the laws have not actually stemmed the flow of vulnerability reports to vendors based outside of China, right? So Chinese companies are still reporting bugs and the laws have had minimal impact so far.
Yeah, so they class it as not significant impact, which is slightly different from minimal. What they did was they looked at all the reports that were given to Microsoft, Red Hat, and a couple of other organizations, and they tried to classify them into Chinese or originating from China or not, and then they basically just chart them over time. And mostly they don't see a huge difference. And that makes sense to me because I don't think those laws were ever about stopping vulnerability disclosure to vendors. In fact, they explicitly say you must report to vendors. and you can't give them away or can't report them through contests and stuff like that. So it's about maintaining control of China's hacker community.
Well, it's also about looping in and CCing the Chinese government. So if something really bad is coming down the pipeline, they get a heads up, which seems like sensible policy, I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, that actually does make sense. And I think that's definitely part of the motivation. I think there is also a motivation to give their intelligence agencies the heads up as well, but that is not exclusive of informing the vendor.
Yeah.
So anyway, they looked at that. They didn't find a significant effect. They sort of thought that maybe something was happening with Microsoft, but not enough to actually call it. But what they did find was that adding Qihoo 360, which is a Chinese cybersecurity company, to the entity list actually had a huge effect. So that company had been dominating Chinese vulnerability reports beforehand, and basically those reports all just disappeared. There's no other Chinese group that stepped up to replace them. So I guess it's an interesting question as to what happened to all that Chinese research that was going on in Qihoo 360. Did that entity listing actually cut off a whole lot of vulnerability reports that we've never seen since and have gone off somewhere else? Presumably, they're still doing that research. The report doesn't really examine that, but I think that's an interesting question.
Well, it is too, and it's also like a bit of a, you know, we're observing a negative effect of an organization in China being added to an entities list. Now, that's not to question the decision. I'm sure it was a sound one, but it's just interesting when you think for a second, geez, there was actually a cost to us of doing that.
Yeah, I wonder, in fact, if that was even considered at the time. So there may be good reasons to put Qihoo 360 on that list. But I wonder whether the people who actually made that decision weighed up the costs on the other side. I do think that it probably was, you know, people have got reasons. It's probably the right decision. But I think it's interesting to know that you've taken all the costs into account. It's not a good idea to not take all the costs into account, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So having said that the report didn't find anything significant, there's definitely things going on. So there's the entity list. There's always the chance that the Chinese government could just change its mind, literally overnight, that it thinks that reporting vulnerabilities to US companies is a bad idea, or even reporting vulnerabilities about particular types or sets of software are a bad idea. And I don't think that would have anything to do. The Chinese government doesn't need laws to stop that. It's got other mechanisms where it can tell people what its expectations are, and companies listen because, you know, that's the way the system works there. So the report has basically three recommendations. Now, the first two and they're basically about harmonizing vulnerability disclosure across the US and its allies. So, you know, let's get more vulnerability disclosure going on, make it more global by bringing in more countries. The second is improve vulnerability discovery tools. So just make discovery better. So those are all trying to increase the supply of vulnerabilities. The third one I found really interesting, and that is that they suggest that NSA in particular should track where vulnerabilities are being discovered over time and look and see if they can find patterns. So if there's a particular class or cluster of software that kind of makes sense as an entity, and see if the disclosures suddenly decline. And that might indicate that all the easy bugs have been found and only the hard bugs are left. Or it might indicate that somewhere in the world, someone is stopping those bugs being reported. The paper argues it doesn't matter why that's happening. What it means is that the bugs that are left have become much more valuable. And therefore, we should spend more money trying to find those bugs. And so they suggest, you know, increasing bug bounties, focusing research on those kinds of bugs. So I thought that was really interesting. I'm not 100% convinced on the logic of what they call it counter-cyclical investment, but I think it is absolutely worthwhile tracking disclosures over time and seeing what's going on.
Yeah, what you say there about this idea of like, well, if bugs aren't being found in a certain technology, maybe we need to do counter-cyclical investment to what, like shake out more bugs. That seems a weird... I get what you mean, that the logic there seems a bit screwy, but maybe they could explain it to us. I don't know.
I found that part of the paper quite hard to decipher. So that's my interpretation, to be clear. Mm. And the link that makes the least sense to me is that the absence of bugs means that the bugs remaining are more valuable. To me, the absence of bugs doesn't tell you anything about how valuable the remaining ones are. They may be super impactful or they may be quite minor. What you know is that there's just, it appears that there's less bugs available.
So look, I think really the point that you made earlier is the important one, which is getting hung up on an individual Chinese law or regulation kind of misses the point, which is that China can be quite agile when it decides to, you know, prioritize something or decides, hey, we want to mobilize, you know, the hackers within our borders to only do thing X. That's something that they can, you know, that the Chinese government can do pretty much instantly because it has complete control. The CCP has complete control. So, you know, perhaps we need to think more about that than individual rules and regulations that actually seem in many ways to be quite sensible.
Yeah, I actually kind of got the feeling that the way that this report was justified was by hanging it around a law so that the argument to the editor or the person who approves that body of work is that, well, there's this law, we want to investigate the impact of that law. Because if you don't have something to hang it around, you know, what's the point of that research? I actually think the research, just looking at the disclosures over time, is valuable in and of itself. But it feels like to me it was kind of shoehorned into looking at it through the lens of this law, which I, like I said, I think kind of misses the point of the dynamic over there.
Yeah. All right. Well, Tom, you're in. People can go and check out your newsletter for more analysis. And of course, there's a bunch of stuff covered in the newsletter that we do not have time to talk about here. But it was a pleasure to chat to you, my friend. And I'll look forward to doing it again with you next week.
Thanks, Matt.